You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, pals and gals, corralling at this locale, not getting a root canal. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 221, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your typical type founders making typos about typhoid and typhoons.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Well, without further ado, let's jump straight into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Here I have a random Trivial Pursuit Genus Edition card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers ready. Let's answer some questions. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. All right. As of 2016, which two countries, both in North Africa, boast the only two subway systems on the whole continent?
Wow.
Ooh. Can you read that one more time?
Which two countries, both in North Africa, boast the only two subway systems on the whole continent? Colin.
I will guess Egypt.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Second one, this gets a little trickier. Morocco.
Incorrect.
Nigeria?
Yes, it is Algeria. So the Cairo Metro opened in 1987 and the Algiers Metro in 2011. So actually pretty new.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Pink Wedge for pop culture. Which TV show's 522 episodes were aired on FXX on August 21st, 2014 and played for 12 straight days for your binge watching pleasure? Ooh. Dana.
I almost feel like you should give it to Chris because I feel like his household watched all of them.
Oh.
Is it The Simpsons?
Yep, yeah. The Simpsons. Okay, Yellow Wedge. From which root vegetable were jack-o'-lanterns originally made?
Oh.
Good job, Brain's first Halloween show. Colin?
Yeah. It was radishes? Turnips?
Turnips. So it says turnips are correct. People also carve beets and potatoes in order to ward off those who might bear them ill will.
If this is your first time listening to the show, maybe you never heard that episode, I really, really encourage you to go Google the turnip jack-o'-lantern because it's just, frankly, equal parts frightening and hilarious.
But they're so small. I think that's why they look
the hard part.
They look kind of creepy in those old photos. It's like it's not a lot of real estate to carve, and also they shrivel.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
All right. Purple Wedge. Next question: which prolific artist, famous for his quote paintings of light, hid the number 5282 in his work to honor his wedding date, May 2nd, 1982? Everybody was waiting for me to finish the question.
Well, it's just like the question is just, it's like you get the answer in the first like four words, and then the rest of it just goes on and on and on and on and on.
Colin,
anyway,
you buzzed in.
I believe it is Thomas Kinkade.
Indeed.
Correct. I have no idea who this person is.
You would, if you saw his work, you'd be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wait, how would you describe it?
Foresty, cottagey.
Like a greeting card, but a boring greeting card, not a sassy greeting card.
I might be wrong on this. And if you're a Kincaid fan, I'm sure you'll correct me. But isn't one of his features of his paintings that there are never any people in them? Like they're like little houses and they're lit from inside and they look very warm, but there are no, actual people.
These look like paintings where, like, if you get cursed, you get trapped in them.
Right.
It's very, pastoral witches from Roald Dahl. All right. Okay. Green Wedge for science. Which type of engine uses the same basic technology as a pressure cooker? That was Dana.
Steam engine?
Steam engine. I don't know.
Okay, sure.
Orange Wedge, last question. Which carbonated drink, patented in 1885, has a name that is synonymous with the word gutsy? Chris.
Moxie.
Correct. New England's own Moxie soda.
I was going to say Pepsi, like, because I know it has to do with like the peptic. And I was like, gutsy, like your stomach is gutsy. Yeah.
I think they were all at that time, the marketing was around for ailments and for being sick.
Yeah.
Here, have a sugary soda. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Possibly with some controlled substances in them.
Uncontrolled at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
LOL. Here you go. Enjoy.
I feel good.
If this show has taught me anything, anytime I ever research any product that's over 100 years old, it's always just like, it originally contained heroin.
I know. They were like, we found this amazing thing.
Yeah. Our marketing campaign is great. Oh yeah, you think it's the marketing? Yeah, that's what you think it is?
For babies.
Yep. Yes. Heroin for babies.
All right. This week's episode. I don't know that this is a surprise to anybody. You know, we're pretty big nerds. We're nerds. And I think we spend most of our time reading, researching. This week we're going to be talking about books and things on print. I think all of us are pretty voracious readers. So this week, it's another one for the books.
Did you all have this when you were growing up where you call the library and you can ask the librarian a question and then they go research it and tell you the answer? I did that all the time when I was a kid.
No!
That's so cute.
I don't think I was doing it out of loneliness. It was just, I was always curious about something. and then it would be like, oh, you could just ask somebody. And I loved it. And then when the internet came, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was a very early adopter of the internet because I just like to look stuff up. Anyway, so I made a quiz for y'all about librarians. People I hung out with a lot when I was a kid on the phone, at school. Like, I thought they had magical powers. They knew everything.
Right, right.
Yes, so you guys buzz in. I think it'll be a mix. I'm curious if you'll get all these questions. Some of these are maybe deep cuts, but we'll see.
Ooh.
Okay. All right. So kicking it off. On Sesame Street, which human worked as a librarian for 31 seasons of the show?
Holy cow.
So this was like the librarian. Other people did the librarian,
maybe
but she didn't.
Work together. Oh, it's a she.
I know.
It's
I
a
just
she.
Leaked a hint yep. for you. Yeah.
31 seasons. No. Okay. Oh,
no.
All right.
It's not the person I'm thinking of.
Okay,
they know
maybe
what
you're thinking
was.
Of who I'm thinking of.
Well, I'm not going to say because I don't want to ruin
well,
it.
Well, I'm going to say it. Only human female I can name is Maria.
Mm. Right.
I thought she had the store.
She has the bicycle repair. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
She did some librarian stuff, I think, at one point, but she didn't do it for...
But that's not her. Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Who?
That would have been my guess, too.
Who else was...
Long-term.
Another female character.
Another female character.
Was on there for...
A long time. Maria. Everybody knows
human
Maria.
I'm sure I'm going to kick myself when you say it.
You're right.
Ready? Linda.
Okay. Oh, Linda. No. Yes, yeah. Of course.
Linda librarian. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you guess which main cast Muppet was the self-proclaimed library expert? Like, out of all the main Muppets of Sesame Street, who do you think was like, I'm the library expert? Chris.
If it's not Bert, I don't know who it is.
Bert? Oh.
No.
No?
It's not. He likes libraries, but there's...
Yeah, he would. He would
Who's
love
an expert?
The, Self-proclaimed, right? Expert?
Yeah.
Or...
Grover.
It's Grover.
Could it be Grover?
He's self-proclaimed a lot of things. There's one other Muppet who works in the library sometimes, and her name is Francine Lloyd Wright. She's a worm. Who works in the library. I love it. What is librarian hand?
Librarian hand.
I think I know.
It's gotta be when your fingers are like stained black with like library ink from stamping books and like library hand is all the ink on your hands.
That's my guess too.
No?
It's a good guess, but no. Karen?
Is it your obsessive compulsively trying to straighten things?
No, but that's amazing too. But librarian hand it's the handwriting. Like, they were trained in a real specific handwriting.
Oh, really?
For the card catalogs. Like, Melville Dewey was helped popularize librarian hand so people could use the card catalogs. So it's kind of like a serif font. It's very neat. They learned it in library school in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Whoa.
Librarian hand. Okay. Which Italian adventurer, whose name is now synonymous with a womanizer, was once a librarian?
Wow, how come Chris. You guys don't know?
Casanova. Yeah.
Casanova spent the last decade or so of his life as a librarian. And
really?
He did. Yeah, he worked for Count Waldstein in that man's big library. But he really just sat around and wrote a book about how many people he had sex with. Like, that's what he wrote the book was when he was a librarian.
He's, like, he's there to meet chicks.
He's like, ah, finally, I have the time and I'm the gonna, space.
I got a story for you. So, like, on Parks and Rec, the show Parks and Rec, Ron Swanson's ex-wife is the deputy director of library services. Mm. What's her name?
I don't Colin. Know.
That is Tammy. Yes. I forget if it's Tammy 1 or Tammy 2, but it's Tammy.
It's Tammy 2, okay. Played by Megan Mullally, who's Nick
Offerman's his real wife.
Real wife, yeah. Which DC superhero earned a PhD in library science and ran the Gotham City Public Library?
Gotham City Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's gotta be...
Barbara Gordon, Batgirl, yes. Batwoman.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yes. Hmm. Dr. Barbara Gordon. And then I guess she stops being a librarian after the Joker storyline where she gets shot. But
she becomes the Oracle.
Yeah. So she's real good at managing information. And she puts that degree to use. All right. In Game of Thrones, Samuel Tarly briefly works in a giant library reshelving books and being trained as a maester. What is the name of the training complex that houses the library? Like, where is it? Chris.
The Citadel.
The Citadel in Old Town, yes. But, I found this amazing article by these academics who were talking about Game of Thrones library specifically. They study medieval books and kind of how libraries have worked in the past. I loved this quote, I have to tell you. They go, despite the absence of visible retrieval aids, coding systems, or catalogs, and while he is by no means an expert librarian, Game of Thrones Sam Tarly is able to reshelve books in the Citadel as part of his chores in his first week as a novice. In our opinion, this is a truly remarkable feat, rivaling Daenerys' dragon riding and Arya's sword skills. Books in the past didn't always have the names on the spine, and there's card catalog. So how is this guy, how does he know
Who's
where
new?
To put any of these books back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, the character of the librarian is turned into what kind of animal?
Oh, man.
Do you know?
It's been a while.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay, well, is it an animal that would make sense?
There's like pros and cons to being this animal in a library. I guess pros. And so this character never goes back to being a human.
Yeah.
Stays this animal.
So many
because
friends
they like it.
Who
is it a worm? Like a bookworm?
No. It's random. It's an orangutan.
Okay. And,
yeah, like to be able to climb up to the high shelves with the arms and only
that's
speaks
actually a great
in
great imagery.
Yeah, it was great. Okay, and then the last one. Grace Ann A. D. Candido wrote in a 1999 article for the American Libraries that I'm not alone in the belief that the appearance of this school librarian has done more for the profession than anything in the past 50 years. This wily and attractive professional is our hero librarian, a pop culture idol whose love of books and devotion to research hold the key to saving the universe every week. Okay, what school librarian is she talking about? This is 1999.
Okay.
1999, when she wrote this.
I was going to guess it's Evie from the Mummy series, played by Rachel Weisz.
That is a famous librarian, but that's not who. This is like a sexy man librarian.
Sexy man librarian?
Yeah.
99. High school? University?
High school
librarian.
Mm-hmm. This is a TV show. It's very adventurous.
I'm scared people are going to yell at us.
Well, is the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
It is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So what's the name of the librarian?
Niles.
The heck out of me.
Ah, you're close.
Giles.
Yes.
Yes. There's a lot to me of librarians who are like, yeah, Giles was the gateway to wanting to be a librarian. Or I love the way he makes our profession so cool. Good job, y'all. Thank librarians. You. Do God's work. Bring us the information.
There was a brief period when I was in maybe, I want to say third or fourth grade, and I went to like a community school. And so this is down in LA, and my mom for about a year was the school librarian.
Cute.
It was very cute. And again, being a very kind of nerdy, bookish kid, like I felt kind of cool, like, oh, I could go in at lunchtime and, you know, check out books, I guess, you know, just because like I had an in with the librarian. But it was
Colin has a hookup.
I got a hookup. Yeah. But I remember very clearly on our breakfast table at home, she made on a big piece of poster board, like a hand lettered Dewey Decimal System guide that sat above. I will forever remember. Yeah. Dewey Decimal System, and just picture it with my mom making that poster.
I used to put fake bibliography citations in my paper before the internet existed. I was like, no one's going to catch me, because they're all like, you have to put three sources. I just made up books and names and years. No one's going to check this sixth grader's work.
It's really, did you format it correctly? It's like, oh, that looks right.
This is how you cite. They don't care about who you cite, you know, and the names I came up with were all really generic and stuff. Yeah. Thomas Smith.
Your report gets peer reviewed. They're like, turns out you fabricated all the data.
So on the Good Job Brain Twitter account, we recently retweeted someone who was like freaking out and losing their mind over discovering why we call uppercase letters uppercase and lowercase letters.
Yep.
In his tweet, he had a picture of the actual case. It stemmed from printing press olden days, where letters were casted in metal and they're stored in a giant kind of storage box. And of course, they're the letters that are stored on the top shelf, which is the uppercase, and then the bottom shelf, which is the lowercase. And then someone else on that same thread, listener Nick Webster, noted that the printing press storage box of letters is also where the phrase "mind your P's and Q's" came from, because lowercase P's and lowercase Q's are mirror image of each other.
That's where it came from.
And they're located next to each other in the alphabetical order. Because at first I was like, wait a minute, B's and D's are very similar, or like P's are just upside down D's.
I should add a note here, maybe to head off some internet chatter, that the mind your P's and Q's is, there are many, many origins for this one that people suggest. That does seem to be among the more plausible. But
that makes more sense.
But you're going to get people saying, no, it's mind your pints and quarts. It's from the old English pub days. You're going to, but...
So this has totally inspired me to look at the phrases and words we use today that originated from the tradition of printing press and typesetting. And Colin, I know you love this realm of stuff. Can you give us a quick recap of how the printing press worked?
There was a case of the little individual cast metal letters, uppercase, lowercase. You would line the letters up, the little metal letters, you know, of course, mirror image. So you have to be able to sort of imagine how they're going to look and make sure they're spelled right. And there's spacing and alignment, and you get them on and you basically clamp them in on the sides, and you're making a big stamp. Like if you've ever gotten one of those craft store stamps with a little pad, it's the same basic idea, just scaled up to letter or, you know, newspaper size. Yeah.
Before that, people had to write it, right? Mm-hmm. Just write copies and copies of it. And so I think when I was a kid, I had to do like a little mini paper, probably with a fake bibliography, about the Gutenberg, you know, printing press. And I think when I was a kid, I didn't really understand. I was like, okay, sure. Yeah, this was a great invention, whatever. But it wasn't until I was an adult, I was like, oh, changed everything. Automate, we can print high volume of stuff. This is how people learned about things, how people were entertained, is reading. And so here I have some phrases that derive from the tradition of printing press. So we talked about the case, the storage box, it's huge, and the metal casted letters, like the stamps that live in this box, they're called sorts. So each letter is a sort. So letter K is a sort. Letter C is a sort. And so a collection of them would be sorts. Printers back then, depending on what they're trying to print, what they're trying to typeset for, maybe they lost a few letters. Maybe they don't have enough letters for what they're trying to print. And so they would be out of sorts.
I thought that's where it was going to go, but that's crazy that that's where that came from.
If you're feeling out of sorts and you're not 100% on top of it or right, or you're flustered, that's because
your page is missing some letters.
Yep, you're out of sorts.
Think of, yeah, I'm sure you guys have seen this too, like movie marquee or gas station lettering with the hand plastic. And, you know, sometimes they're out of an E and they just like, they'll, you know, they just turn the three around or, you know, just exchange of ones and lowercase L's as needed. Yeah.
It's like, this movie title has too many Z's. Nobody has this many Z's. We'll just put the N sideways.
Yeah.
It's like really wide. So obviously setting type and letters in a plate is a very, very tedious process. So to make things more efficient, with common sense, people started to cast words, like common words together. So instead of, you know, let's say the word and, instead of having the letter A-N-D, they're like, hey, let's just move this process along. Let's just have a stamp for and. And so some of these common words from... two really, really common like prepositions and conjunctions, and eventually evolved into like the name of the company, because people are printing things and they have to put their company name in them. And then people started to get a little bit fancy and artsy with them, maybe design them with some decoration, more stylized fonts. And these are called logotypes. Mm-hmm. Which is where we get the word logo from. Like a company's logo is from their logo type, because it's a repeated one piece of a stamp. People also did this to common phrases. So they would just have a whole block of phrases that people use. They also did this with generic images like a tree or a snowflake. So these common templated things that were commonly used took on the French word for clicking, because they're clicking the piece into place. Cliche. Describing things that are commonly or maybe like overly used.
Yeah.
Other terms, probably a little bit more obvious. Hot off the press.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, make an impression. So impression is what I think the British term for, we say printing, but for them, the proper term is impressing. Because we're impressing an image or text onto a piece of paper. So when you make an impression, that's what we're impressing, that stamp onto a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So say you're working at a newspaper factory and you just put together, you just did typesetting for a whole plate for the front page for the news tomorrow. So we got to print a lot of copies and you have this one plate. So what are we going to do? We're not going to print all of it from just one plate because it's going to take a long time. It's going to degrade the letters, the sorts in the plate. So what do? We need to make a copy of this completed plate. Well, how do we do that? So printers developed a system where they would make from this mother plate molds. The common thing is they would imprint this using paper mache.
Okay.
And they would wait for the paper mache to kind of set and dry. Huh. Then they poured metal on it. So now we have the complete front page in one big metal press. This system was called stereotyping. In 1946, this is for the New York Times. So that one plate, that mother plate, they would cast as many as 6,000 copies of plates so that they can like keep up the demands.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I have for the printing press movable type period. And in between then and now, which is where desktop publishing, there is a period in the middle where it was phototyping.
Yeah.
And essentially it is giant Xerox. Instead of using stamps of letters and words, they're cutting it out of paper. It's pre-printed text that it looks like a giant ransom note. You know, so so if you're making a newspaper then, it was just a giant ransom note. Okay, I'm gonna cut out a picture and then cut out words, and this is where copy and paste comes from. This is where clip art came from.
Exactly.
There used to be a book of just generic art that you literally clip out using scissors, to put it on your page so it can be photocopied.
When I was first starting to learn desktop publishing, some of like my mentors and people that I worked with, older coworkers, they came up in this environment. They say they could like smell the glue that you would use to like, you know, do the paste ups. And
that's
like,
wild.
I just, it seemed like learning from somebody from another era, just the pre-digital yeah. era. Yeah.
That's all the news fit to print, you guys.
So, yeah. So I was thinking about books, because that is the topic of this episode and was trying to, I don't know how I landed on this is what I wanted to talk about, but I'll say this. I went as preparation for this. I went to the Good Job Brain fans and Lobetrotters Facebook group that we have, where thousands of Good Job Brain fans gather to discuss things. And I posted a poll. I posted a poll and I simply gave them the prompt. So do you smell books? And I gave four potential answers that I was hoping everybody would fall into. We got 220 votes so far. I'm looking at the results right now. Yeah, a lot of people wanted to vote.
That was just from yesterday.
That was just from yesterday, yeah. And so the most popular answer of the four options that I gave people was, I enjoy the scents of books, but I don't go out of my way to sniff them. No. with 47 votes, the second most popular answer was, absolutely, I jam my nose into the gutter and inhale deeply every book every time. 13 votes, no. No, not my thing. No real interest in the scent of books. And then two votes for, I only just now found out this was a thing and I'm super weirded out. I was very curious, actually, who would fall into what buckets here. I did this because I am absolutely an unrepentant book sniffer.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I just for the same reason that I might, when I get my glass of wine, I may swirl it to release some of the aromas and stick my nose in. It is a very pleasant feeling to inhale a pleasant aroma, and I absolutely find the aroma of books. Some books don't smell great, but when a book smells really good, it smells really good. And so I was just like, okay, Karen's smelling a book now. They smell great.
It's your book. I'm smelling your book.
Karen is now smelling, I think, every book on her shelf.
Yeah.
I assume the smell of books is like fresh kind of ink, clean chemical.
Yep, scent with
a little bit of like paper nuttiness. Am I right?
Yeah, sounds about right. In an actual scientific study, not a Facebook poll, a real scientific study, that was conducted in 2017, researchers presented people with the scents that came off of historic books, old books. And they collected the scents and then kind of disassociated them from the books. They didn't give people a book to smell. They said, smell this sort of isolated scent and try to describe what it is you're smelling. Like, what do you smell? What's the scent there? Number one, with a bullet, scent that people said that they got off of the scent of old books was chocolate.
Huh. What? Huh.
Yeah, was the scent of chocolate, followed very closely by coffee. Huh. You saw lots of people saying, I smell, you know, burning or wood or ash, things like that. But chocolate was the number one answer. Researchers posit that, you know, this is because books and chocolate and coffee share many what are known as volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. And those are the things that give everything their smell. VOCs are the things that the compounds that give off parts of themselves. Those parts go up into our nose and we smell them. And in fact, books and chocolate both contain lignin and cellulose, some of the main substances that are in wood. Lignin itself is actually very close in terms of its makeup to vanillin, which is the scent of vanilla. And so lignin is even used in some cases to make artificial vanilla flavoring.
Really?
So, So a lot of times when you're smelling, and we're talking about old books that are starting to break down and release, you know, more of those compounds.
Definitely a difference between new book smell and old book smell. Yeah.
They're made with, I would say, it seems like a little bit more organic materials back then.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, there's one compound called furfural, Furfural. Furfural. Mm-hmm. That they actually use that to determine the age of some books, because more of it ended up in the compounds of older paper, that like paper that used more like linen and cotton, you know, versus like kind of wood pulp. It smells like almonds. And again, they can use it to date books, how much furfural is coming off of it. When lignin breaks down, that's what kind of causes books to start turning yellow as well, when the lignin starts leaving. When you eat a chocolate bar, often there's vanilla flavoring in the chocolate bar, right? So, I mean, there is like this, that combination of chocolate with vanilla notes that can come off of old book. Now, old books that are in good preserved condition and weren't exposed to a lot of moisture, because if you're smelling old books and they smell like mold, or, you know, the musty basement smell.
Yeah.
That's just mold. In newer books, which can also smell fantastic, what you are smelling is not the paper breaking down. You're smelling whatever the inks are used on the paper. Also, they can use other compounds on the paper as well to treat the paper and make it more durable. Yeah. So you're smelling those. And then also adhesives, like you're sniffing glue when you're smelling a new book. And then, of course, books, for most people, I would hope, remind us of happy times spent with a book. And of course, we know that smell is very close to the memory center of the brain. And so that's why a smell can be so powerful and bring back a certain time or place. You know, if you enjoyed your time reading books, like that smell is sort of transporting you back to that as well. And so that's kind of the idea of like, why do people really enjoy the smell of books? Not only is it a pleasant sort of reminder, but it's also, it just smells like chocolate sometimes. Yeah, there's scented candles that smell like everything. But yes, there are scented candles that smell like old books that you can order.
I have perfumes that are formulated to capture that smell as well.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, somebody mentioned in the Good Job Brain a fan group post that there's a company, specific company called Demeter Fragrance Library. Yep. Yes. Which sells things in, it turns out, all kinds of weird scents. So there's paperback, but also kitten fur,
grass.
Yep. Yeah. Gin and tonic, junior mints. You want to smell exactly like a junior mint, and crayon. If you want to
smell like crayons, I do.
You just want little kids to bite you.
The last sort of corollary to this is, if you smell a book and it does smell bad and you don't want it to smell bad anymore, I actually go through this a lot with video games, because often I will buy a video game on eBay and it will come in and the person did not disclose that they are a chain smoker and they've had this thing for 30 years and it smells. The attic smell, the basement smell, but also the smoking smell. What I will generally, you can put it into an airtight container with odor absorbing material. So you can put a book, you shouldn't put a book directly into kitty litter, but it's like, if you put a book into a loose container and then put that into a container full of kitty litter, so the book's not touching it, but it's all in the same atmosphere, then airtight, then seal it up, the kitty litter will absorb the bad smell off the book and leave it in there for a long time. You know what I mean? Like, leave it in there for like a week or whatever. I actually use dryer sheets, unscented fabric softener sheets.
I've heard the dryer sheets.
Yeah.
Put those in between pages, or, you know, wrap it around the video game as the case may be. Put it in a Ziploc. Wait for a while. If it's like a mild smoke smell, it should be gone within a day. If it's really strong, you might have to throw it in the trash. I mean, yeah, but there are absolutely common household solutions that you might have lying around right now that you can use to get rid of bad smell.
Okay. All right. Well, everybody, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with more books.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm at a grade school in Chicago. We're going to find out if these teachers listen to Good Job Brain. Emperor Qin Shi Huang ruled China until his death in 210 BC. How did he die?
Oh, it was definitely C. He was crushed.
Mercury poisoning, D.
Ding, 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 ding.
No way.
Way.
Awesome.
Betty White or penicillin?
Which came first? No, penicillin.
That's crazy.
So you would learn all of these things if you listened to Good Job Brain.
I should. I will.
And we're back. Colin, what do you have for us?
Okay, Karen. Well, I took this a little more broadly, but I think we are absolutely, certainly, safely within the realm of books here. But let's talk about writing. If you have been on the internet, used Facebook, worked in an office, or even touched a personal computer at any time in the last 25 years, I am 99% certain that you are familiar with the topic of this segment. This is something that is reviled by many. It is earnestly, perhaps ironically, loved by many as well. And there is honestly not a whole lot of ground in between those positions. Mm-hmm. I am talking about the typeface known as Comic Sans.
Oh. I've changed my opinions on it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what, Karen? I've gone back and forth and back and forth. I have to say. Like a lot of people, you know, maybe in the design or type and font world, it's easy to sort of get caught up one way or the other, either defending it or hating on it. I'll give you a description here. If just the words Comic Sans are not sparking any recognition for you here, I'm going to quote from a very wonderful book called Just My Type by Simon Garfield. It's a very Colin book.
Good,
yeah,
good name.
It's a great book. Yeah. So here I'm quoting here. He says, even if you didn't know what it was called, you will be familiar with Comic Sans. It looks as if it was written neatly by an 11-year-old. Smooth and rounded letters. Nothing unexpected. The sort of shape that could appear in alphabet soup, or as magnets on fridges, or in Adrian Mole's diary. If you see a word somewhere with each letter in a different color, that word is usually in Comic Sans. He says, you know, Comic Sans is a type that has gone wrong. And I think that is in some ways true, but it has a very redeeming, to me, very interesting story here. And it, just as an aside, I may use font and typeface interchangeably. Please just accept that and go on. If you don't know what I'm talking about, then it doesn't matter.
Just be cool.
Please leave me alone.
Please. I know, but it's please. Okay, so Comic Sans was created by a man named Vincent Canore. Vincent Canore in the early to mid 90s was a typographic engineer for a little company called the Microsoft Corporation.
Okay.
At work one day, Vincent was reviewing a pre-release copy of a program called Microsoft Bob. Now, I think we've talked about Microsoft Bob on the show before. You know, again, it may be lost to the mists of Good Job Brain time. If you don't remember, and if you were not perhaps alive in 1995, Microsoft Bob was a program or an interface, a product that was created to serve as a super, super user-friendly interface for sort of that era of Windows operating systems. Okay, Windows 3, Windows 95, even NT a little bit. And, you know, Microsoft, like a lot of companies, felt like maybe this need to really hold your hand and teach you how to use the computer.
I see.
Okay.
It came with a lot of common programs of the time. There was a word processor. It had a calendar, a planner. It had a basic kind of home finance app in it. It was stuff that you might need if you were just sort of the average, you know, American personal computer, Windows buying family. It used a metaphor that was actually pretty common in some stuff at the time. It had the house metaphor. Okay. So it was very visual, had a picture of the inside of a house. And, you know, you go from room to room, depending on what you wanted to do. And everything was really heavily visually metaphor based. So when you wanted to open your calendar planner, you'd click on the, you know, the clock. And if you wanted to write a letter, open up the word processor, you would click on the pen and paper on the desk. You know, it had a lot of assistants in it, kind of cartoony assistants that would give you advice and tips. And there was a cartoon dog named Rover who was, you know, pop up and, hey, do you need help doing this? And would guide you with little, you know, little speech bubbles on screens. And
yeah,
came out in March of 1995. It was discontinued in early 1996.
Yeah.
It was never a hit. It never took off. It was just really widely criticized by most of the professional reviewers. Like, they just...
Oh, no.
I mean, the critiques of it ranged from just being too dumbed down, the cartoon characters too cute, too over the top. So anyway, for whatever reason, or I should say for all of those reasons and more, they took Bob off very, very quickly. But yeah, you know, it did kind of spiritually live on into a lot of the later Microsoft Office assistants, which in their own turn were widely criticized, but that's how it goes. So our friend Vincent Canori was reviewing, a pre-release, unreleased copy of Microsoft Bob. He saw something he didn't like. And specifically, what he didn't like was the typeface they were using. They were using, in the release that he was looking at, Times New Roman for all of the text, all of the labels everywhere. And again, you know, Times New Roman, if you don't know the name, it's just a very, very, very traditional serif font, boring, newspaper. You might say, newspaper. Right, yeah. Exactly. Vincent felt that Times New Roman really felt out of place with kind of the tone and the vibe that they're going for.
That
they're like
sense, yeah.
Cartoon characters. This is soft and fuzzy and rounded. There's dogs, you know, I mean, this just didn't feel right. Yeah. And so, you know, so he said to the Microsoft Bob team, he said, hey, you know, have you worked with the, the kids software team?
Yeah.
You know, maybe they have some ideas here, maybe type-wise that you can kind of tie it in a little bit more. Sounded like maybe that didn't really go anywhere. Ultimately, you can see where I'm going. Vincent Canori decided, you know what, I'm going to create a font here for them. Mm-hmm. And he designed Comic Sans. The word comic is right in the name. It is, in fact, inspired by comics and comic books. And in fact, one of the books that Vincent had in his little workspace there by his desk was Batman, The Dark Knight Returns. The very, very well known by Frank Miller, Klaus Janson, Lynn Varley.
Wow.
You know, he also had taken some inspiration from Watchmen, another great, well-known, gritty of comic and now trade paperback from that era. Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons, of course. And he really took a lot of inspiration from the hand-lettered, organic feel of those comics. And so he drew the letters by hand. He drew the entire alphabet that he, you know, felt that the program needed, got it pixelized just the way he wanted it. He sent the files to the Microsoft Bob team. He's like, guys, people, this is great. We don't need to use Times New Roman. We can ship this thing with this awesome font that I've created for you. And they said, wow, we cannot use this.
Why?
Well, for a couple reasons. One, partly because they had designed all of the screens, all of the interface around the sizing expectations for Times New Roman already.
Right, yeah.
So just from an aesthetic layout perspective, having to move margins or change things around, it was a problem. It just didn't fit, frankly. It wasn't that they didn't like it, you know, necessarily. So Microsoft Bob was in fact released with Times New Roman as he saw. Who can say to what extent the font type choice was part of its downfall?
Was he working at Microsoft at the time?
Yes, yes. Like... This was all no. He okay. was. This was. Yep. That's right.
He
was.
He wasn't on the Bob team. He waited till they had a release candidate, and then he's like, "You know what? You should change all of your font to this thing I made for you. I'm not on your team.
Yeah.
I don't care about the people who." Had a bunch of meetings and talked about this and figured it out. I'm just going to go for it.
Dana, it sounds like you're familiar with software development.
Oh, yeah, maybe I've done some software development before. That would be so annoying. Wow.
That's true. This whole time, Colin, your tone is like, this dude is kind of like a hero. And Dana's like, no, he's that guy.
This is making me dizzy. This thought of somebody like, I redesigned your whole thing.
So Bob came, it went, he wasn't part of that, but he had created this font system and it did in fact become adopted for Microsoft Movie Maker, which was a very successful piece of software for them. And, you know, thinking back now, you know, when I read this, I was like, yeah, you know what? I do kind of remember in the 90s seeing Comic Sans on a lot of sort of home video slideshows and It was a hit. Great. Of course, as I mentioned, this was 94, 95. It was bundled as a typeface in Windows 95. Which is how it's sort of, you know, if we were tracing a...
Start me up.
Yeah, if we were tracing a virus here, this, yeah, Windows 95 was a patient zero, I guess, right? and again, as Simon Garfield notes here in this wonderful book, like if you are the average kind of home user of Windows in the 90s and you're making something at, you know, a book report or something fun, yeah, what are you going to use? You're going through that little list of fonts. You might very well decide, I don't want to use Times New Roman, I'd rather they use Comic Sans. It exploded. I mean, it really maybe leapt sort of the bounds of proper use by by whatever your definition. You'd see it on ambulances. The Portuguese national basketball team used it for the names of the players in the back of the jersey. Yeah.
No!
I read it would be used in some online adult sites would use it for their, you know, font branding, just really places that did not seem appropriate. Into the late 90s, there definitely started the backlash of the anti-Comic Sans movement. There was a husband and wife named Holly and David Combs who started selling banned Comic Sans merchandise. And they would catalog some just crazy places that it was used as well. Like, they've documented it being used on tombstones. Someone from South Africa, I guess, contacted them, let them know that they had a textbook, their Afrikaans textbook. The entire textbook was printed in Comic Sans.
Oh my God.
I would go nuts after just a couple pages. Yeah. Aww. They found a use of a pamphlet handed out to patients about irritable bowel syndrome, again, printed all in Comic Sans. Yeah. Vincent Canore, he really took this all in stride because, again, he's a professional and he understands the nuances of fonts and type and how it's used. And then not everybody is going to use it with the same mindset as a professional. He's gotten a letter from Disney thanking them for his contribution. Disney has made a great use of Comic Sans. The letter was in Comic Sans, signed by Mickey Mouse. I'll close here with a joke, again, cribbing from this wonderful book. Comic Sans walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "We don't serve your type."
Oh, no. You should sue them.
Yeah, that's discrimination.
Yeah.
What's worse? That or the brushstroke font,
ooh.
Mommy Needs Wine font.
Oh, Karen.
That one, the Live, Laugh, Love font.
I liked that before.
Karen, I have the results here of a 2007 survey published in the Typographic Papers series. This was a questionnaire sent to more than 100 designers, asked them to list the ones they liked the least. Coming in at number 5 was Brush Script. Coming in number 4, Papyrus, of course, another.
Yeah. Avatar.
Yeah, the Avatar font. At number 3, Newland Inline, or Neuland, perhaps, Inline, the Jurassic Park font, you know, the American Spirit Cigarettes font. Right. Number two, Ransom Note. Yeah, like this one is just...
It's communicating.
The legitimate subversive use cases zine. For Ransom Note. Yeah, right. Subversive zine. Right.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
a Ransom Note.
Yeah, right. And an actual Ransom
Imagine
Note.
Imagine a textbook all Ransom Note.
Yeah.
A Shakespeare play in Ransom Note.
I was in a story meeting when I was at Wired one day, and somebody was like, "Oh yeah, and we'll take the letters and kind of, you know, cut them out in the presentation. It'll look like a murder letter." The whole room is like,
"Wait, what?
Ransom note? Like, oh yeah, you know what I mean?
The murderer letter? Yeah,
yeah." Why, what do you call it when you make one, you know?
Well, yeah, it's presupposing that there'll be a murder, you know? Like, it's not just a kidnapping.
Right. That's really, you're assuming your ransom letter is not going to be successful. And just to not to leave you guys hanging, this might be maybe a sign of when this survey was taken. The 2012 Olympic font, London, was ranked as the number one most hated font among the designers in the survey. I actually had to look
what
it up.
What font is that? Yeah.
It was a really kind of angular. One writer observed it looked like the equivalent of dad dancing. Just, you know, something just trying so hard to be cool that it fails.
I see a little bit of Greek glyph and kind of
yeah, you're right. You're right. It does. You're right. But surprisingly, Comic Sans did not make the designer's own list of most hated fonts. So maybe that speaks well of it.
Because it's really like saying you hate your grandma if you hate it. You know, it's just like she sends me these emails and comic fans.
My dad emails PowerPoints like of memes. Like, you know, we send each other memes and stuff, but like all of their memes are in a PowerPoint file with music that you have to download, and it's slideshow of like not even memes, like funny web comics or whatever. Oh my god, it's like so not efficient, your memes per second.
Yeah, it's like forward.
It's a chain PowerPoint. That's I never open it because I was
you should
like,
never
I
open it. That's viruses.
I know
that's what's downloading and taking so long.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Colin. I got our last segment, and I didn't know you were going to talk about Comic Sans, and I have a quiz here that is in the same vein as what you talked about.
All right.
My segment here is called From Panels to Frames. It is a quiz about movies, films that came from or adapted from graphic novels or comics. So here I have a bunch of questions. Get out your barnyard buzzers. Here we go. Number one. Nobody could stop Cameron Diaz's star trajectory after her first film acting gig in this smoking movie. Ooh, Cal. Dana.
The Mask.
Correct! The Mask. Yeah. Didn't know until today that The Mask was based on a comic by Doug Mankey and John Arcudi. The comic is super dark and not like the movie at all. Ooh. Next question. This gritty Chicago mob drama was the last movie appearance of Paul Newman and features an all-star cast including Stanley Tucci, Daniel Craig, Jude Law, with Tom Hanks as the lead.
Oh,
it's really good. The film is very good.
That one.
Wow.
Based on graphic novel.
Huh. Wow.
It's one of the few roles where Tom Hanks plays a, not that he's a villain, like he plays like a mob, like a gangster dude who kills people, which is a very un-Tom Hanks thing to do, but he's still the hero of the film.
Yeah. Oh man, this is,
This piece of work is called Road to Perdition.
Yes. Road to Perdition,
based on a graphic novel written by Max Allen Collins and art by Richard Pierce Rayner. Fantastic movie. Last movie appearance of Paul Newman before he retired, I think, in 2007. Salad dressing king himself, Paul Newman. Okay, before she got us to love-hate her in Game of Thrones as Cersei Lannister, Lena Headey played Queen Grogo in this battle epic.
Battle epic. Okay,
this battle epic.
Battle epic, battle epic, battle epic.
Queen Gorgo.
Oh, Gorgo. Gorgo or Grogo?
Gorgo. Grogu. Like Gorgon with no Grogu. Queen Grogu. Colin.
Well, this is a guess. Was it 300?
Correct. It is 300.
Oh yeah. Okay.
This is Sparta. Cersei. Her name's not Cersei. Lena Headey. She was the queen, like the Spartan queen. This is 300. The graphic novel written, illustrated by Frank Miller. We just talked about. Next question. This film and comic takes place in a post-apocalyptic Australian outback. The comic was created by artist Jamie Hewlett, who then afterwards went on to create the band The Gorillaz. This film stars Lori Petty, Naomi Watts.
There we go.
Ice T, Malcolm McDowell, and Iggy Pop. Chris, you buzzing first?
Tank Girl.
You are correct. It is Tank Girl. Commercial flop, but beloved cult film.
Boy, they wanted that one to be such a hit. I remember the
you know what? It was pretty quirky and pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the comic book was made by Jamie Hewlett. And if you look at it, it looks
a lot like Gorillaz. Yeah.
It looks like the Gorillaz stuff.
Totally does. Oh, that's a good one.
It's his style. We have two last questions, and I want you guys to work together on it. We, of course, associate Chris Evans now with playing Steve Rogers, Captain America. But did you know, in addition to the Marvel movies, he starred in 4 other films based on comics or graphic novels? Oh, can you name the 4 other films?
I can name one.
Well, okay.
He was in Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four, yep, by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. He was the Human Torch.
Yeah.
There's 3 more. I could give you guys clues.
3 one, more. Goodness. Okay.
He played an ex-boyfriend.
Oh, he was in Scott Pilgrim.
Correct.
Oh, right.
Pilgrim versus the World by Brian Lee O'Malley. He was one of the ex-boyfriends.
Yep, yep.
And 2 more. He was kind of like an anti-hero in this Korean movie about a train.
He was in Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right. That's right. I forgot that was an adaptation. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Snowpiercer, a Korean movie, but it was actually the comic was French. Jacques Laub and Jean-Marc Rochette.
Yeah.
And the last movie you might not know, it's called The Losers. He played, it was kind of like special elite team doing like a heist. Also has Zoe Saldana, who played Gamora, Idris Elba, who was also in Thor. Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who became the comedian, the Watchmen.
All-star comic-based cast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan also in Walking Dead, and Idris Elba also in the new Suicide Squad, right?
Well, so here we are. Last question. Not to be outdone, Josh Brolin has played a character in 6 movies based on comics. Can you name all 6? He currently has probably, I think, the record.
I mean, I think we can all name at least one, right? He does Thanos in
he is Thanos Avengers. From Avengers.
Wow, 5 more. Okay. Was he the Sin City adaptation? Was he in that?
Yes,
one?
He was in Sin City 2.
Okay.
He replaced Clive Owen.
Okay.
I'll give you some hints. He played a young version of Tommy Lee Jones in a movie.
Men in Black?
Yep, he's in Men in Black 3, also based on a comic.
Okay.
One, he played a Western bounty hunter with Megan Fox. Do we remember that movie?
Megan Fox.
It's a DC character.
Do not?
It's a Jonah Hex.
Jonah Hex.
No, I don't remember that, no.
He was also Cable in Deadpool 2.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yep. And then the last one, this is probably the only manga Japanese comic in this quiz. There was a manga called Old Boy that got turned into a Korean movie, award-winning Korean movie.
Yeah.
And then that was adapted to the Western audience, Old Boy starring Josh Brolin and Elizabeth Olsen. Wanda.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's so funny. Okay.
Just to recap, here we go. Josh Brolin's big 6. He was Thanos in Avengers, Cable from Deadpool 2, Old Boy from the manga Old Boy, Men in Black 3, Sin City 2, and Jonah Hex. Good job, Josh.
Yeah.
From the Goonies now to the top.
Good job, Josh's agent.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, if you guys recall, we have been floating in outer space this entire time, because a few episodes ago, we received a challenge from our old nemesis, Carmen San Mateo, who stole a trivia prize from us and escaped into orbit somewhere. So we're playing Where the Heck in Space is Carmen San Mateo right now, and we were voyaging in our FARTIS when we picked up a mysterious signal over the space radio or whatever, and this signal was an endless loop of a series of numbers. Now, we could not solve this, so we turned to you folks out there in podcast land, the listeners, who correctly surmised that the numbers should be transposed into letters. One is A, two is B, and so on and so forth. And this gives you K-L-E-O-R-I-O-N-S-B-U-C. Now, unfortunately, that means basically nothing, but it was a loop, and we didn't know where the loop began and ended. So, as it turns out, the way to actually spell something with that would be to start with the first O, and you get Orion's Buckle. So then, of course, you realize that the star formation in the night sky that we know as Orion's Belt has three stars in it, and thus came to the conclusion that Orion's Belt Buckle would probably be the star in the middle. And then you Googled it, and then you found out that that star is named Al-Nilam, and that was the answer, A-L-N-I-L-A-M. Al-Nilam was the name of the star that serves as Orion's belt buckle. Then you went to goodjobbrain.com and you typed that in to learn that that was the correct answer. So off we are traveling, everybody, to Al-Nilam, a brief 2,000 light years away from our from Earth. Or actually, I mean, it turns out that Al-Nilam is about 40 times the size of our sun. And is estimated to be about 500,000 times brighter. So let's just get within spitting distance of Al-Nilam. So now that we've arrived in the general vicinity, whose name, by the way, is derived from the Arabic phrase for a string of pearls, Orion's Belt, being a fairly recognizable sort of concatenation of stars in the night sky, is recognized by different cultures, even if they don't know about, you know, Orion the Hunter. In Arabic languages, it's often known as the Belt or the Line, and in some places, including Chinese mythology, it's known as, like, the scale or the weighing beam, because it's a balance,
like,
it's
like a straight line
with three things, like a balancing scale type thing. Anyway, none of this is going to help us. but what is that once we arrive in the general area, we spy another vessel out of our viewing holes. This is a spaceship that seems to be in the shape of a wireless handheld microphone. We begin to receive a transmission. Hey, Gumshoes, it's us, Macapella, everybody's favorite non-instrumental, non-infringing parody musical group. 5, 6, 7, 8. Carmen isn't here, she's somewhere in the Milky Way, hiding on a moon named for a lady in a play. In other words, she has fled. In other words, use your head. Now, that little ditty's not going to give you the complete skinny on Dee Dee and Carmen's whereabouts, but we did hear Dee Dee tell Carmen this. Daughter of Hermione, mother of Lucky. Now, what that means, don't ask us. We're just a simple, legally distinct group of doo-wop singers on a voyage into space. And it's time to get going to infinity and then past that.
That was great. I finished it. I loved it. 5 stars.
Thank you. I'll let Macapella know that you said so. Macapella, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
They're keeping it legal.
Their production value really went up.
When you have extra time to spend on it, you know, traveling to people in outer space, you want to really double out on the production value.
You have you just have a lot of time to think and really get those harmonies tight.
Okay, what are our clues?
We had clues. So in the song itself, I believe, what did they say? I think they said that Carmen was hiding on a moon or somewhere in the Milky Way, hiding on a moon named for a lady
named after
a lady in a play. And then we got another little hint at the end after that. Daughter of Hermione, mother of Lucky. So I don't know. I wouldn't even begin to speculate or even provide any hints here. to the people, listeners, we need you again on this one. You're going to have to figure out where Carmen and Dee Dee Convict have blasted off to.
Help us get to the next place, mm-hmm, everybody. We got to catch Carmen San Mateo. Please visit goodjobbrain.com, our website, and you'll see a little Fardis, and we're going to punch in the code. And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about smell of books, librarians, graphic novel, and Comic Sans. You can find us on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, and on all podcast apps, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Clever, Movie Therapy, and Ben Franklin's World. And we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.